Okay, folks, you are listening to Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. I want to first of all thank you all for all the feedback we had into Planet Porky. I have an array of co-presenters now who are of such classic talent in their ability to communicate that we are becoming world-renowned, okay? And I'm delighted to say today I have with me once again Lord Snooty. His real name's Sam, by the way, but we call him Lord Snooty because he's got that very mellifluous, very posh voice, and he brings a superior sort of feeling to the proceedings. So, Snooty, may I welcome you once again to Planet Porky?
Well, thank you very much indeed. It's always a pleasure to be here, Mike. I do like the surroundings in Planet Porky, I have to say. It's a very nice environment. It's very comfortable. We feel very at home here.
Very kind of you. And it's always nice to get on the rocket and get up here, isn't it? You know?
Certainly is.
And settle in. And I have to say, I have a lot of feedback from the last time you and I were in the studio, Sam. All very positive. People think you're keeping me in line, you know what I mean?
Well, quite right too.
Like as if I need keeping in line. But you look at it from a different perspective because, of course, you are from a different generation to me. You're from the woke generation. Now, first issue that I want to get onto on Planet Porky today, Sam, is because I haven't seen you since it really erupted big style. What is your take on the Duke of York, the position he was in, the interview he did with Emily Maitlis, and the position he finds himself in now?
Yes, well, I think the position he was in is a little bit the operative phrase, really, isn't it? If you think about some of the things that have been going on over the last few weeks and months. This is an absolute scandal, a real outrage, isn't it? I'm absolutely amazed that a further external investigation hasn't taken place yet to try and bring him to some kind of justice.
What do you think he's guilty of?
I think he's guilty. Well, to be fair, I mean, if the accusations or the allegations that he was having sex with a 17-year-old, I suppose there's nothing illegal about that per se, is there?
Well, when I say guilty,
it's a bit distasteful.
I say in inverted commas, of course. I'm saying, what do you think morally he's guilty of? Because he's not in front of a trial or a jury or anything like that. But where do you think his behaviour has veered so far off what's acceptable to become unacceptable?
Yeah, well, I think that the problem is that it's, I mean, we know about the Duke of York, don't we? About his some of his behaviours. He's very rude to people when he's in public. He's a very unfriendly kind of man. He's very, I mean, obviously, being a member of the royal family, he's entitled, but he's very, very overly entitled, isn't he? I mean,
I'll tell you the story I heard during the week, because almost everybody I talked to now wants to talk about the Duke of York. I've done him on television this week. I've done him on radio. And the one story that sticks out in my mind is that I think he was the patron of some 260 charities, most of which he's now rescinded, but one of them is a military charity, and it involves staying in a country house. I mean, you know, in this country we have fantastic country houses, don't we? Shooting parties, all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely,
you know? And I don't know where it was. It could have been the Yorkshire Moors, it could have been Scotland or somewhere like that, but he stays overnight in this country house with his royal bodyguard, and you know, it's probably got 30 bedrooms or something, and there's about a dozen people there, and they come down in the morning and he's the last to get down for breakfast. You know, nothing wrong with that, I suppose. Depends what time they went to bed. But he walks into the dining room and he walks two paces and then stops and then gestures with the palms of his hands upwards like that and says, I think we'll try this again, shall we? And he was indicating that he expected everybody in that room to stand up as he entered the room because he was the Duke of York. And he was slapped down because the mistress of the house, whoever that was, she might have been the Duchess of somewhere, you know what I mean, or something like that. She said, excuse me, sir, this is my house. And as far as
quite
I'm concerned,
right,
my guests have been perfectly respectable to you. They've greeted you as sir or your royal highness. I do not expect my guests to have to stand up in my house when somebody, whoever they may be, enters the room. And so Andrew just turned on his heels and went.
I mean, it's absolutely pathetic. But I think the thing is, I would say that this is not very becoming of a royal. But actually, if you look over the annals of history,
it probably is
quite becoming of most members of the royal family over history, over the course of time, isn't it, really, in terms of nefarious behaviour? Mm. I mean, actually, I was thinking about this the other day. This is the sort of thing that will go down in legend in the course of, you know, in 50 years, 100 years' time. They'll all be talking about, oh, do you remember that that prince who was a bit of a, you know, philanderer, a bit of a naughty, not just a philanderer, but, you know, somebody who was kind of hanging around with unsavoury crowds and the wrong type of people and all that kind of stuff.
That's right,
Whereas actually, it's been a fairly I mean, you know better than me, Mike. You're much more well-versed in the current royal family
Absolutely.
Than I am. But I would suggest that this sort of scandal, aside from perhaps the Princess Diana situation, is probably been the thing that's blighted the copybook of the Queen more than any other.
I would say so. I think you're right. In her 60 years, she's had few crises like this. I, of course, was the man who broke to the world the news that Diana, Princess of Wales, had died. You know that, don't you?
So you tell us, yeah.
No, not so I tell you. It's there in black and white, mate. I put out the snap release, urgent snap release, Press Association London, 4:20 a.m. in the morning on the day that poor Diana had died in a car crash, and I notified the world for the first time that sources which have been in touch with the Press Association indicate that Diana, Princess of Wales, has died in hospital of her injuries in the car crash. I mean, historic beyond words. And one of these days I'll get all the credit for that and I'll go down as a legendary journalist. But it's not about me. It's not about me, obviously. The other thing... but you're absolutely right. It's a terrible blot on the copybook. And by the way, the Queen and Charles acted so ruthlessly. I mean, Charles is in New Zealand. He's talked to his mother on a round-the-world telephone line, so to speak. You know what I mean?
Right.
Side, he's got to stand down, and all of a sudden he's been sacked by the royal family. But there's so many things you could say about Andrew. I've never met him, but I've been in his company a couple of times at golf tournaments. He always comes to the Open, and I remember
what are you doing at golf tournaments?
Well, Mr. Brazil and I used to take our breakfast show there for about the six successive years.
Oh, I see, you were drinking. Right, I get it.
No, our breakfast show. Our breakfast show starts at 6 in the morning, goes on till 10, you know.
That's never stopped you before, Mike.
You're attacking my character again. A studio 200 feet above the 18th green.
Oh, right,
spectacular.
Okay.
Most spectacular. You have to walk up all this scaffolding steps to get into the studio so you can see right across the course, you know.
And
it is brilliant watching a golf course wake up in the morning, you know, seeing all the caddies come out. You know, the caddies come out at like 5 o'clock in the morning.
Do they? To sort of assess the course and all that kind of stuff.
To inspect the greens.
Yeah.
But I mean, you see, I'm so ignorant of things like golf when I first started this business 20 years ago. I didn't know that they move the flag every day.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Did you know that?
They
move the where the hole is on the green. So if you
I didn't know that.
So you think yesterday you got it absolutely right, you know, and you've got up to the green in two, and you think you know where the hole is. Haven't they moved it? They moved them overnight, and they've got they've got this incredible machine which is just a cylindrical bore, and it goes down into the ground, and it takes enough, you know, earth out to form a hole, and they put the cup in, and then they go and replace that into the hole that's just been vacated.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah, and that's why they have to walk the whole course, and that's 7 miles, you know. Sometimes.
Have you ever played any golf in your time?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I've got a great set of golf clubs made for me by Callaway, made to measure in the Callaway Scientific Museum at Chessington in Surrey.
Right. Not George Callaway.
No, that's Galloway, actually. Yes, yes. Yeah. He made a joke. Lord Snooty's having a laugh with me. You stand there and you swish around with golf clubs and all that. All these millions of pictures are taken,
right,
transmitted back to Florida, where Galloway HQ is. And then 6 weeks later, this huge set of golf clubs arrives in a Callaway bag made to measure clubs.
That's tremendous.
Yes, it is. Absolutely tremendous.
But you've never used them, I take it?
Well, I must admit, it's a while since I've been out on the course because I've had other things to do, you know. Ploughing the furrow on Planet Porky and all that kind of stuff. But no, what I was going to say, so at golf, he would always turn up on about the second or third day.
Right.
You know, in a Rolls Bentley, you know, with an escort of police and all that kind of stuff. And his sense of entitlement was, you know, all the waiters from the, you know, the 19th lined up outside the clubhouse for him and all that kind of stuff. And always struck me as being pug ignorant. And no wonder, you know, during the course of the last 2 weeks, when you learn more and more about this guy, he was known as HRT, his royal thickness, because he is incredibly thick.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where it is.
But I think the thing is with someone like Prince Andrew, it's a bit like with this whole scandal. I don't want to equate the same sort of thing, but you know, the whole Catholic Church affair where you've got all these priests and ministers who have kind of history of abusing small boys and stuff.
Yeah.
Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting that Prince Andrew's done that,
but
I just mean the entitlement and that feeling of absolute power whereby you can kind of get away with anything and no one will judge. Well, even if they do judge you, who cares, because you are ultimately the Duke of York, you know?
And it doesn't matter if your fingerprints are all over it because yeah. there's nothing anybody can do about
yeah.
it.
Yeah, untouchable.
That sort of
yeah.
attitude, isn't it?
Yeah.
That, that thing about the Catholic Church, you're absolutely right. Don't want to get into that.
But no.
The scale of that was revealed to me the first time I ever worked in America in the early 80s. And I was sent a book, and it was a book about the how much the Catholic Church had paid out post-war to cover up scandals in America. In America alone, they paid $450 million to cover up scandals involving priests attacking minors.
$450 million?
Yes. Yeah, it was incredible, honestly. And,
it's featured in that great film Spotlight, where the I think it's the Boston Globe or one of the papers did the whole expose with the investigative journalism
sounds
on the
like
Catholic
Boston.
Church.
Boston's
absolutely fantastic.
Such a big
fantastic
sort of religious centre, isn't it? And, you know, I'm not a religious guy, really. I'm Church of England, okay? And I
go regularly, do you?
Well, I go when I can. I go when I can, you know, but lives are busy. And football these days on a Sunday doesn't always make it easy to go to church if you're travelling.
Isn't there,
you know,
a church at Goodison Park?
There's a Catholic church on the corner of Goodison Park. It's the only one in the world, I think. It's the only other place that's got a Catholic sort of presence is the Nou Camp. And Alan Brazil making his debut in Europe for Ipswich against Barcelona. Couldn't understand as a 19-year-old why all the Barcelona players were suddenly dipping out of the you know, the team queue and dipping through this little archway in the tunnel, and they were going in to give it the Hail Mary before the game.
Is there a chapel in the stand or something?
No, there's a chapel in the players' tunnel.
Oh, it's in the tunnel, is it?
Yes, in the tunnel. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Amazingly. But no, what I was going to say is that, funnily enough, this all comes together. Remember Sinead O'Connor, the singer?
Sinead O'Connor, yeah.
Sinead O'Connor. And nothing compares... Nothing compares. Can't hit that high note, I'm afraid. That left me some time ago.
Song written by Prince, of course.
Exactly, yeah, written by Prince, brilliantly. And she went on to an American TV show.
Oh, yeah.
And ripped up a picture of the Pope and said, "This is the world's real terrorist," you know. And
they,
yeah. And this is in America, you know.
You know, they took well to that, didn't they?
Well, they took terribly to it. And that was on, like, the Wednesday night or something. On the Saturday, right, I went to Madison Square Garden to cover a concert that she was in, because she was number one in this country then, you see, with Nothing Compares. She comes on the stage. For some unknown reason, Kris Kristofferson was with her. You know, he was like a sort of musician stroke actor, wasn't
he? Yeah,
yeah. But they were big buddies, and she came onto the stage and she got booed and bottles were being thrown at her. And it was I couldn't believe it. It was a great story. You know, I was primarily there to cover it as a review of her concert, you know.
Right.
Britain's number one singer, you know, takes a stage at Madison Square Garden. And it turned into a brilliant front page story about her being attacked, you know, bottled and all sorts of things. Yeah. But the point I'm gonna make is she said the Pope is the world's real most dangerous terrorist, because she was actually talking about the vows and the rules which Catholic priests have to take.
Right, right.
And all she was saying was, if you let Catholic priests get married, you wouldn't have any problems. Mm. And I have a lot of sympathy with that view. I mean, the idea that religious people take the vow of silence and they live in a monastery all their lives. What percentage of human beings could put up with that? Very, very few.
Yeah,
very, very few.
Very,
very few. And you'd have to be rather odd and rather strange to want to do that.
Didn't you say you wanted to do that on a recent podcast?
What I said was that if I decided that I needed some space, I needed to get my head together and wanted a period of reflection after what can only be described as an interesting and busy life.
Tumultuous, perhaps.
Tumultuous indeed. I might then go away too. Why are you grinning when you say tumultuous, you see? You've got that sly grin on your face, you know, like, I've caught Porky out, you know.
No, I just like using big words.
Big words, okay. And what I was going to say is that, yes, I might go for a period of reflection, but I'd have to do it somewhere like Nepal or something like that. Just to make more, or Kathmandu, I think. Kathmandu, to make me think that I was nearer the spirit of John Lennon, you know what I mean?
I see.
Because
you'd find the spirit of John Lennon in Kathmandu, would you?
Well, he was very fond of Kathmandu, because if you remember, one of his later songs, Nobody Told Me There'd Be Days Like These,
yes,
he talks about UFOs over New York and Ain't You Not Surprised, Nobody Told Me There'd Be Days Like These, and he mentions within it a trip to Kathmandu. He's very fond of Kathmandu.
Wasn't there also talk that the Beatles' last album, Abbey Road, was going to be called Everest?
It was.
And they were going to try and go out there and film it, like, you know, we'll record, take the picture of the cover of Mount Everest or something ridiculous like that.
It was going to be called Everest, and that was absolutely certain. And they all got into the Abbey Road Studios one morning and said, right, we're all going to Nepal.
Can you imagine?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Imagine saying that to John Lennon.
The only place in the world where they probably wouldn't have recognised the Beatles, you know, in the middle of Kathmandu.
Yeah, that's right, yeah, yeah. And John Lennon, you know, I think he was a heroin addict at the time.
But
he was certainly into drugs, you know what I mean? And he said no way was he going. Ringo didn't want to go. George Paul, who was always the most creative in terms of looking outside the Beatles, you know what I mean?
Ideas and stuff, Sergeant Pepper and all that.
Yeah, exactly. Thought it was a great idea. They said no. So the photographer had to come up with another idea there and then for a cover picture for the album. He said, I'll tell you what, we'll cross the road in Abbey Road. And that's how it came about, completely by accident, you know. One of the most famous pop images of all time. And it happened just like that. And talking about the Beatles, by the way, I tell you, I had the absolute pleasure to work with this week, John Challis, who was Boyce in Fools and Horses.
Oh, right, yeah.
Only Fools and Horses. So I'm working on a TV show. One of the other guests is John Challis. And he's 77 now. But, wow, what a terrific guy. And so, you know, full of humility, considering one of the most famous faces on British television. And the reason I brought this up is because he was interviewed as a young man for a slot on Magical Mystery Tour.
Oh, right.
You remember the... I mean, you probably don't, Sam, because of your age. You certainly won't remember it being made live because it was in the, like, 68, 69. But the Beatles made this hopeless film called The Magical Mystery Tour about them all piling on a bus and driving around Kent, you know, or somewhere. And it was just a load of nonsense. But it was all drug, you know, fueled and all that kind of stuff. All terribly wacko stuff and all that kind of stuff, you know. And John Challis, as a man in his early 20s, was told by his agent to go down to this place and to audition. And he didn't realise. He walked into this room and he was being auditioned by the Beatles. Yeah, I mean, you couldn't believe it. The most famous men in the world.
Did he not recognise them then? Or he did?
Oh, he recognised them, but he wasn't told what it was about. He wasn't told what it was about until he got there, you know. And he was absolutely shell-shocked, you know. And John Lennon said to him, what's your favourite Beatles track? And John Challis, unthinkingly, because he was so nervous, shaking, said, well, actually, I prefer the Rolling Stones. And yeah. And they all laughed. And Lennon in particular got up and patted him and said, you know what, sometimes so do I. And he got the job.
John would have loved that sort of humour.
Absolutely. He got the job. But then what happened was his agent had found him another job the same day for more money, so wouldn't let him do it.
Oh, what a nightmare.
So he, in the end, he didn't do it. Right, OK, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. I am the Porkmeister. I have with me, of course, Lord Snooty. I tell you what, Snooty, do you know it's rained for every one of the last 40 days? Did you know that?
Was it?
Yeah. That's St. Swithin's style stuff, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
If it rains on St. Swithin's Day, it's going to rain for 40 days. But apparently it's been the wettest autumn we've had for a very long time. Now, that brings me to our next very important subject, and that is trying to avoid getting colds or flu in this sort of weather. And of course, it's worse when it rains, isn't
it?
Yes. Because it's damp. People then are wrapped up in clothes, they get on trains, they open the coat, they shake all the germs off, all that kind of stuff.
The infection spreads, doesn't it?
Awful. Now, I've come across a miracle cure, which I have informed my Twitter followers about, right? But I want to tell you more about it in detail. So I was doing TV a few days ago, and of course, my voice is my fortune on radio. My voice and my face is my fortune on television.
Can't make much money on TV then.
Oh, that's very nice, isn't it? Do you know who you're talking to here?
Hey? I'm talking to the Porkmeister.
You're talking to the Porkmeister.
A radio
yeah.
legend.
Yeah, well, we were talking a few minutes ago about the entitlement of the Duke of York, a member of the royal family.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just show a bit of respect, will you, for the Porkmeister. So I'm thinking to myself, I can't possibly go into that studio tomorrow and have a rasping voice, but more, I don't want a streaming eyes and all this kind of stuff, you know what I mean? Anyway, for some unknown reason, maybe because I am smarter than the average bear, I suddenly remembered a miracle cure that I'd been reading. I read all the health pages all the time because I'm looking for a magic cure for my heart. Only one third of my heart works. And in fact, only last week, I sent a 2-page letter to the successor to my cardiologist, Dr. Nicholas Banner.
Oh, is Dr. Nicholas Banner retired now?
He's retired.
Has he?
At Harefield, yes, yes. And a great, very great man. And I hope he has a very happy retirement. Dr. Banner, if you're listening, thank you very much for all you've done for me. And we will meet again, I'm sure, at one of the charity dues or something like that. Anyway, a lady has taken over from Dr. Banner, and I sent her this two-page note after I'd read in one of the health journals that an injection of stem cells is now aiding recovery in lots of parts of the body. I mean, you know, without giving people false hope, it has in some cases managed to weld back together the spinal cord things, you know what I mean, inside the spinal cord,
right,
the nerves,
right.
The nerve endings and all that kind of stuff, giving people hope that they might be able to walk again and all that kind of stuff. And one of the ones they mentioned in particular was the sort of heart disease I've got. I've got dilated cardiomyopathy. It means the left-hand side of my heart, the left, big left chamber. There's two chambers in your heart, on top of your heart, and two below. Two big ones on top, two below. The big one on the left of my heart is just overextended, and it goes out too far, and it takes longer to come in, so it doesn't give the blood as much oxygen when it's pumping it round the body, and you get tired and all that kind of stuff. So I wrote the letter, and the doctors acknowledged that and had a look at that, and is going to see, because the thing about health is that in this country, it's National Health Service. I could go abroad and get this done, but then would the National Health Service in this country look after me if it went wrong? What do you think?
I think probably not. I mean, we've heard about quite recently these disasters of things like surgeries where people try and pay for their own surgery out in places like Turkey, where potentially it could go wrong. And
to have their bottoms lifted.
Yeah, all that kind
of
stuff.
To have their buttocks lifted.
Yeah, or boob jobs, or that kind of thing.
Yeah, but that's all cosmetic, Sam. That's all cosmetic. I'm talking about, you know, real health issues like a dodgy heart.
Well, I mean, I think people would look after you, wouldn't they, if you came back over here?
Well, I don't see why they should. If you go abroad and you know, for want of a better word, you get some sort of cowboy quack surgeon, you know, who operates on you somewhere, like you've just said, these ridiculous...
Yeah.
Mind you, I'm not dismissing the cosmetic stuff. Some of it's tragic. The most recent story was a lady who died after she'd had some sort of collagen pumped into her buttocks or something like that. You know what I mean? So that's very tragic, and one has tremendous sympathy. But no, I wonder whether there's a coalescence of doctors around the world, so that, you know, when one heart doctor operates on you in somewhere and another one will look after you. I don't know. I don't know whether you deserve
to. Are you talking about going away and getting some kind of experimentation kind
yes,
of treatment then?
Yes.
Well, where? Where would they do that kind of
well,
thing?
Well, they'll do it in America.
Right.
Right.
Well, you wouldn't want to go out there. It cost you a fortune.
Well, this is the point. America's very advanced, so it probably wouldn't be cowboy-type stuff, but it would cost $100,000, and that would be for an injection of stem cells, OK?
I don't think you'd want to risk it in somewhere where you think it might be cowboys, would you? You know,
well, America's not, though, is it?
No, America isn't.
No,
absolutely
no,
not. You're either going to be out of pocket or you're going to be out of an organ. I don't know which one's worse, really.
That's true. But anyway, I came across another one only last week. And again, I wrote to my my cardiovascular consultant, and it's some kind of drug, you know, some new drug which was originally developed to aid diabetics.
Oh yeah,
of which I'm also one.
Okay,
I'm very qualified, you know, in terms of medical deficiencies. You know that, don't you? You know. Apart from having a dodgy heart, I'm a diabetic, I have frozen shoulder, sciatica, you know, so, what are you laughing about, you know?
It's a bit of a miracle that you're still with us, isn't it, really, with all
well,
these ailments?
Well, I suppose
ailments.
It is, but, you know, I have the resolve to, you know...
You're like the bionic man.
Yeah, the bionic man, but I have the resolve to look life in the face and laugh at my adversity, you know what I mean? But, no, quite seriously, whether you can go abroad and have all those done or not, I don't know, but I'm very, very pleased with my cure for the cold. I haven't told you what it is yet. Have
no,
I?
You haven't
Sorry.
Told
no,
you
no, no, no. So I wake up and it's about 2:30 in the morning. I thought I've got to get rid of this right now. So I went into my kitchen, got a big tumbler, and filled it full of water, and then poured an inch of salt into it and stirred it round very, very fast.
Why did you do that?
I'll tell you. So I then went back to one of my bathrooms,
right.
and I.
How many bathrooms have you got?
Three.
Why have you got three bathrooms?
Well, you know, it's a nice apartment. You know what I mean. And I got into the bath at the sloping end with my head in the bath and my feet up on the wall. Right.
Right.
And then I poured all this salted water down my nose. I waterboarded myself effectively.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And into my mouth, so that
you like Chinese torture, do you?
Well, I don't, but you see, this is what I'd read would be effective. What you have to do is you have to swill out all the flu and cold germs out of your whole nasal system. So not just your nose, not just your throat, but you have to get a circulatory effect.
I see.
You know, like sometimes, you know, you can swallow something and it comes up your nose, and like when you jump in a swimming pool, you know, and that kind of stuff.
It's like a sort of cleanse, isn't it, really?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, you know, all I could taste then for the rest of the night was salt, obviously, and breathing salt and all that. But in the morning, you can't believe it, I was better. That's happened twice to me in the last 10 days, and twice it's worked.
Well, hold on a minute. I mean, this is completely ridiculous.
No, it's not ridiculous.
No, it's completely ridiculous, Mike.
Well, how can you say it's ridiculous? Well, because it's worked. I've road tested it. It's worked.
Yeah, but obviously you didn't have a cold, did you?
I did.
It hasn't just cured you by a cold overnight. No. Colds are things that last about 2 or 3 weeks. They don't last night.
What I did is I was smarter than the average bear, and I nipped it in the bud. I mean, for instance, the only thing I could feel in my mouth as I lay on my pillow was a golf ball growing at the back of my throat underneath my tongue. You've had that feeling, haven't
you? Yeah, I know what you mean.
Your tongue's getting bigger. Your tongue's too big for your mouth, you know. And I thought, this is going to be awful. It's going to affect my speech and all that kind of stuff. So I did it, and it just went away instantly. And then I tried it, and then about 3 nights later, it tried to come back again, and I did exactly the same again. Miracle cure.
Is that not a completely and utterly kind of ridiculous thing to be doing, to be sitting in a bath and basically drowning yourself in salt water?
No, not if it works. Why is it ridiculous?
How long did it take you? I mean, is it
about 5 minutes?
5 minutes.
Yeah, that's all. I literally got in the bath, you know, had a pair of shorts on, and I put my head backwards, and I've got, you know, when you lie in the bath, I've got a padded cushion fixed to the sloping end of the bath to rest my head on, so that I can lie there and read newspapers, you know, and that kind of stuff.
Oh, do you normally, you prefer a bath over a shower, do you?
No, I shower every day, but I like to take a bath a couple of times a week because it's nice to have a soak, isn't it?
Right.
But I took my padded cushion off and put it on the flat bit of the bath so that my head was raised so I could get the salt water right down my throat, right down my nose and nostrils and all that. And believe me, it worked.
So where did you find this ridiculous quack-type method for curing a cold?
As I said to you, I am an ardent reader of journals, right, which include medical journals. It could have been the BMJ or something like that, the BMA or the British Medical Journal or something like that. And as far as I'm concerned, it worked. And it is something that I will swear by from now on.
So are you telling me then that with this new method that you've got now, that you're going to be telling the millions of Planet Porky listeners that this is how they can cure their ailments?
Well, I'm not saying that, you see. You see, you're jumping to inclusions here, Lord Snooty. What I'm saying is it worked for me. Now, I'm not advocating that, you know, everybody who listens to this should immediately rush off to their bathroom, get in the bath upside down and pour salt water.
Dr. Mike Parry recommends.
Yeah, well, yeah, but I'm telling you, it worked for me. And if it worked for me, then as far as I'm concerned, it can work for other people. But it's all about how people take it. However, funny enough, only the day before yesterday, because we were working together this morning in this studio, and we like to get things started early, I knew I'd be on a packed commuter train, okay?
Oh, I see.
So I went and got the jab 2 days ago. Do you get a jab?
Is it the jab for what? For flu or colds? Or?
It's the vaccine against colds and flu in the winter.
I haven't had the jab. No.
No.
No. I don't think I'm quite at the age yet where I need the jab, really.
Well, you say that, but did you get cold or flu last year?
I've never had the flu.
Oh, really?
No, I've never had the flu.
Never?
No, never. I've never, ever had the flu. But I do get colds every now and again, of course. But I just get over it, don't you? Just get on with it, get over it.
How come you don't get the flu?
I don't know. I think some people just don't get it. I think some people sort of, you know, how some people are kind of carriers and some people are kind of getters.
Yes, I think.
I might be a carrier. I probably just carry it around and pass it on to people, but I actually get it myself, which is quite nice.
Good God.
Well, I say that now. I'll probably end up getting bedbound for about 3 weeks with the flu, but so far, touch wood.
Yeah, well, okay. Well, no, good luck to you. If you've got a sort of natural resistance to it, I think that's a very good thing indeed. Right, okay. Now, I'll tell you what I want to talk to you about. Have you been watching much telly lately?
Bits and pieces. Why, what's
War of the Worlds?
Oh, I've heard about this.
Have you not watched it?
I haven't seen it yet. No, you're going to. Is this a Porky recommends?
Well, first of all, my attention to it was driven years ago, before you were born. A group called the Moody Blues made an LP called War of the Worlds as the theme music for, I don't know, it must have been a film, I suppose, they made in those days. But it was written by a guy called H.G. Wells. And it was read by Orson Welles.
Is this not Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds?
What's his name?
Jeff Wayne. He did the music to War of the Worlds, did he not?
Did he?
Did he did all that big sort of orchestral type album scenario?
What's his name? Jeff Wayne.
Yeah, is that not him?
Well, who was the guy in Electric Light Orchestra?
That's Jeff Lynne.
Jeff Lynne. It wasn't Jeff Lynne.
No, it wasn't Jeff Lynne.
Jeff.
No.
Well, I thought it was the Moody Blues. But anyway, he was great. And was that for a film? Was that for the War of the Worlds film?
I want to say it was like an accompanying soundtrack for something, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think it was a film.
I think it was like a concept album type affair.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But going back to the '50s when it was first written, it was written by H.G. Wells.
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah. And in those days, Orson Welles, Citizen Kane, by the way, was his most famous ever role in a film, and that was about a newspaper proprietor, so that should interest us, being in the media world, you know what I mean?
Isn't it quite dull, though?
Well, it's in black and white, and the thing is, the bits I've seen of it, you're absolutely right, I could never watch it all the way through. It was in black and white, it was in a newspaper office, which is inherently a black and white sort of background anyway, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was full of American quick talk, you know what I mean? So I think really the stage play might have been a better option,
right.
To be honest, Citizen Kane. But no, so the War of the Worlds thing, they've now made a four-part TV programme, okay? Now, one of the reasons I watched it was because one of the most beautiful women in Britain was starring in it, and that is Eleanor Tomlinson.
Oh, I see. You've watched it to perv, have you, Mike?
Not to perv. I very much resent that sort of accusation, but Eleanor Tomlinson, of course, was Demelza, wasn't she?
She's in Poldark, yeah.
In Poldark.
Yeah. Which is beautiful woman, yeah.
Yeah, and it's now finished. Poldark's now finished. And
so you're missing her, are you?
Well, I like Poldark a lot. Did you like Poldark?
No, it's
I love Poldark.
It's a bit too sort of schmaltzy and rom-commy for
me,
I'm afraid. It's a bit Pride and Prejudice, you know?
It certainly was. The only objection I had to Poldark was that old Russ Poldark, you know, Captain Poldark, you know, rars.
Are you taking the mickey out of local accents?
Yes, I am. Yeah, the Cornish accent, yeah. And he was played by, can you remember who he was played by?
His name will come to me.
But he's a great actor anyway. Yeah. I thought he was a great actor. And he played the part magnificently, very, very handsome man. But the problem was, he was surrounded by real villains like George Warlegan, who was his cousin. You know?
Oh, right, yeah.
George Warlegan has closed down the mine, and 400 people have been put out of work.
Aidan Turner,
that's him, thank you, that was Poldark. Immediately, Poldark leaps into action and says, right, I must open another mine to help these people get work. But it's not your fault, Ross Poldark. And you know, if somebody suddenly is jailed for a crime they didn't do, right, it's my duty to break into the jail and get them out. But Ross, you don't even know the bloke. I cannot stand injustice. And he was such a do-gooder, you know what I mean? He would help anybody who was in trouble. And most of the people in trouble were bastards, you know what I mean? Really nasty, evil individuals. But, you know, Captain Poldark, Ross, decided he would help them out.
Are you not generally a fan of a do-gooder then? Like,
well, I think do-gooding is overrated, and also let me tell you this, I love that expression, you know, a good deed will never go unpunished.
Oh yes,
and this is absolutely true. There's been a few people in my life who I've helped out, you know, when they've been on their uppers and all that, and either A, you never get any reward for it, or B, it's even worse, you get a whole pile of resentment coming back at you the other way, you know what I mean?
Mm.
So be very careful, because I know you're a decent chap, Snooty, be very careful who you decide to help out and when you decide to help
There's
out.
There's a song from the musical Wicked called No Good Deed, and it says no good deed goes unpunished in the chorus.
Is it really? Wicked, the stage play?
Yeah, Wicked, it's about, it's a sort of telling of the Wicked Witch of the West and all that kind of stuff. It's sort of an offshoot of The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, really. Amazing. But the thing with Eleanor Tomlinson is that the first time I saw her on screen in Poldark, Captain Rars, she was a kitchen maid. And once again, Captain Poldark rescued her from being in a kitchen of a bully's house and married her.
Well,
you know?
I can see where the appeal is for you, Mike. I mean, you've got a penchant for secretaries, haven't you? So that's sort of menial sort of job, you know?
Well, no, I was
interested there.
That's very harsh. Being a secretary is a very skillful job, and the reason women can do it, men don't, is because they're so dexterous with their fingers, aren't they?
Is that what it is?
And they can type properly.
And is it the dexterousness that appeals, then?
Definitely, yeah. But what I was going to say was that Eleanor Tomlinson, the first time I saw her on screen, is the spitting image of a lady who used to be my girlfriend.
Oh, really?
For a couple of years. Absolutely spitting image. Same sort of auburn hair, same facial expression, and same sort of mannerisms in her face. Honestly,
it's not Brenda, is it?
No, it's not Brenda, no. I had to, you know, do a double take and then get onto Google and make sure the lady I'm talking about from years ago hadn't suddenly taken up acting. You know, seriously, it was the likeness is...
You're telling me you dated a woman who was as good looking as Eleanor Tomlinson?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it must have been a few years ago then.
Well, it was 30 years ago. You're absolutely right. So I thought then, well, maybe it's a daughter. You know what I mean? Maybe
she
went off and got married and she got a daughter or something like that. But no.
Good job it isn't. That would be slightly creepy otherwise, wouldn't it?
Well, it would be, I suppose, a bit. Yeah, but... anyway, look.
Is it any good, The War of the Worlds? That's the question.
Well, do you know what? I've read a couple of reviews because I always have a look at the TV reviews. And it's got hammered a little bit for. I think they're being a bit rotten, really. It's totally unbelievable. Well, it's supposed to be unbelievable. It's, you know, it's about being invaded by the Martians and all that kind of stuff, you know? But I think it's really good. I think they've done all the horror scenes well, and, you know, there's lots of emotional relationships being tested within it all and all that.
So you're going to watch it, then, are you?
Yeah, there's only been two episodes so far. Okay. They did one of those, you know, first night, second night on the trot, and then you've got to wait a week for the third and a week for the fourth. But, no, I'll be watching... avidly to see how my favourite actress of the moment, Eleanor Tomlinson, does when she gets back on the screen. Well, Snooty, anyway, thank you very much indeed for joining me today. As ever, we've covered all the subject that anybody cares about in the universe. Eventually, they all end up on Planet Porky. And again, I wrote to my my cardiovascular consultant, and it's some kind of drug, you know, some new drug which was originally developed to aid diabetics.
Oh yeah,
of which I'm also one.
Okay,
I'm very qualified, you know, in terms of medical deficiencies. You know that, don't you? You know, apart from having a dodgy heart, I'm a diabetic. I have frozen shoulder, sciatica. You know, so what are you laughing about? You know,
it's a bit of a miracle that you're still with us, isn't it? Really, with all
these ailments.
Well,
I suppose it is, but you know, I have the resolve to,
You like the Bionic Man?
Yeah, the Bionic Man. But I have the resolve to look life in the face and laugh at my adversity. You know what I mean? She was the kitchen maid, and once again, Captain Poldark rescued her from being in the kitchen of a bully's house and married her.
Well,
you know?
I can see where the appeal is for you, Mike. I mean, you've got a penchant for secretaries, haven't you? So that's sort of menial sort of job, you know?
Well, no, I was
interested there.
That's very harsh. Being a secretary is a very skillful job, and the reason women can do it, men don't, is because they're so dexterous with their fingers, aren't they?
Is that what it is?
And they can type properly.
And is it the dexterousness that appeals, then?
Definitely, yeah. And I remember we did.
What are you doing at golf tournaments?
Well, Mr. Brazil and I used to take our breakfast show there for about the six successive years.
Oh, I see you were drinking. Right, I get it.
No. Our breakfast show starts at 6 in the morning, goes on till 10, you know?
That's never stopped you before, Mike.
You're attacking my character again.